Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the man who pushed America to war. My guest is investigative reporter Aram Rostin, talking about Rostin's book, The Man Who Pushed America to War. It's a look at Ahmed Shalabi, the extraordinary Iraqi figure who provided what turned out to be false intelligence to the CIA, the Pentagon, and other state agencies. Intelligence that was key to America's decision to go to war in Iraq. More now from Aram Rostin on Ahmed Shalabi. Now, where did this all begin? You write about how a CIA spook named Whitley Bruner was the guy who essentially first recruited Shalabi in London. How did it begin, and then how did he develop this relationship with the folks you call the neoconservatives?
It was a great thing for Shalabi. In a sense, he'd been chased out of Jordan. He fled from Jordan, again, claiming that he was a victim of a conspiracy, but in fact, leaving behind his bank that was devastated by problems, credit problems, all sorts of problems. People lost a lot of money. He flees and lives in London in an apartment his parents had left him, not far from the U.S. Embassy, ironically. And he lives there, but what's happening is Saddam invaded Kuwait. So America's policy towards Saddam shifted tremendously. And this is something that benefited Shalabi. He was a person with whom the Americans could work. He was intelligent, well-spoken, a great organizer, a very efficient organizer. He could motivate people. He could speak different languages. And the CIA was tasked try to create an organization to fight Saddam, or at least to put a public face of the opposition to Saddam. And they're the ones who went to Shalabi first. They began to fund him. But he wasn't supposed to. No one back then ever contemplated, this is the man we want to replace Saddam Hussein. That was the farthest thing from their minds. The idea that they would give Iraq to a former banker who was in disgrace wasn't something that occurred to them. What it was he was supposed to help organize this thing called the Iraqi National Congress. And he did. They began funding the Iraqi National Congress to the tune of about $4 million a year. He did it so well that he was such a good organizer, he basically managed to lead it completely. He took it over. And the CIA lost control of that organization. And then the CIA really lost control of him. And then they began to realize that their money was being spent, and they didn't know what it was being spent on. He was building his own little private army. He was trying to push for incursions into Saddam-held territory. He was trying to really, really light the fire. And it's very fair to say, his opposition to Saddam was sincere and single-minded. He hated Saddam. He wanted to topple him desperately. So there's no doubt about that.
But you also imply very clearly in the book that while he was hoodwinking the American government, taking our tax dollars and driving us to war and leading us to the situation we're in now, that he was at the same time apparently very loyal to Tehran, to the Iranian government, one of America's sworn enemies.
Ahmed Shalabi, I think, is a theme in his life, is that he's very loyal to what we call Shiism, Shiite causes, which it's something Americans wouldn't have even known about, right, maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. But now it's something we all know about. His Shiite identity was very important to him. And, of course, Iran was a place where Shiism and political power came together. And also their opposition to Saddam was Saddam was Iran's main enemy in the region. So they're natural alliances. The other good thing about Iran for him, he couldn't go to a lot of places because of his problems in Jordan. Jordan borders Iraq. It's in the area. Jordan, you know, had good allies in the area. Iran wasn't going to turn him over to Jordan. He could go to that country and travel freely there. So Iran became a very important country for him, notwithstanding the animosity between the U.S. and Iran. And he somehow managed to play that to his advantage so that his supporters in Washington, these neoconservatives and right-wingers in many cases, who were very much opposed to Iran and to Iraq, managed to use him and tolerate the fact that he was so close to Iran.
Have these folks ever backed away from Shalabi, or I'm sure some of them have?
Some have, yes, but many have not, ironically. If you look at the Douglas Feith. Douglas Feith had just come out with a book. He was a big supporter of Shalabi, we all know.
Explain who Douglas Feith is.
Douglas Feith was he was the Deputy Secretary for Policy, Defense Secretary for Policy at the Pentagon. And he was his deputy. He ran the so-called, the very notorious Office of Special Plans, which really dealt with Iraq policy. They were supposed to be coming up with this post-war plan and plan for, you know, how to run Iraq afterwards and all this stuff. And obviously, whatever they had planned for didn't come to fruition. But he's written a book more recently where he blames people, other people. But he was one of the so-called neoconservatives who felt very strongly that invading Iraq was a positive thing if it had been done right. And to there is a weird philosophical issue here. If we look at the invasion of Iraq, the neoconservative movement really wanted to invade Iraq and then basically install Chalabi and several others as leaders of Iraq, obviously propped up by American forces. That was never done. So to a certain degree, they argue, well, if you'd just done it our way, things would have worked out. That's what they'll say. You know, and who knows? I mean, you can't really argue them. You can't, because it doesn't seem likely. You know, this was an insurgency that we all know the insurgency was planned by Saddam Hussein, was inspired, and was going to happen, according to the insurgents and others. But this is what they claim. And so to a certain degree, that's the neoconservatives' claim. They say by not siding with Chalabi, somehow, America will let them down in a way. And they really are. So isn't that a phenomenal loyalty that they could be so supportive of him?
Where did you travel when reporting this book?
Well, I've been to Iraq, but not since 2004. I went to Lebanon, Beirut, that is, and Jordan, and England. And, you know, obviously I spent visit a lot of people in other parts of this country.
Right. You obviously talked to hundreds and hundreds of people, as noted in the book, and probably just as many that whose names were not used.
Oh, yeah.
Ahmed Chalabi, however, was one of the people who did not talk to you.
He would not, no. He knew, and he tried to discourage people from talking to me. He felt the book would be unfair, and I don't think it is when you look at it.
Have you heard how he's reacted to the book?
Well, I mean, he was upset about some small components, but to me, certainly, no substantial factual issues have been challenged, or parts of the book have been challenged that I know of. He's just a charismatic fellow who's so, everybody uses the word Machiavellian and conniving, and people who he's using, they seem to enjoy being used. It's a weird thing. They're still so loyal to him.
Right.
And they don't care what his plans are. They like being around him. One of the things, of course, interesting is his money, his financial, you know, endeavors even now. The way to do stories often is to follow the money. And I think I do that throughout his life. And I think that helps tell his story really
right.
accurately.
And today his nephew is one of the folks deciding where the big dollars are spent in Iraq.
Yeah, isn't that funny? I mean, in other words, he engineered that his nephew, his grandnephew, would run something called the Trade Bank of Iraq, which handles all the letters of all the sort of financing for government purchases in Iraq. It was a weird little irony nobody's picked up on yet, but the day that Ahmad Chalabi got his one government job in the new Iraq, for about a year, he was the deputy prime minister of Iraq, just for a year. But that very day, on April 28th, was the very day that the Trade Bank of Iraq, which was run by his nephew, apparently announced that he was giving a business deal to a company owned by Chalabi's relatives. I mean, the very day. And now, was it an accident? Could it have been a coincidence? It just doesn't seem likely, but who knows?
So Chalabi, who was sent to be the great savior with his Iraqi National Congress, who was going to land in Iraq and sweep America to victory, we know how that turned out. No one voted for him. Nobody knew who he was, practically. He had a bunch of thugs as his supposed army. You know, it was all this sort of Trojan horse that collapsed shortly thereafter. Where is he now?
Well, it's a very complicated thing, trying to figure out his ups and downs. I got to tell you, he's a survivor like nobody's business. That's why he's great to write about. Some see him as very malevolent, by the way. Others see him as just self-interested. Others see him as benevolent. I'm not sure that's accurate. But so now he's back in Iraq. He lives in Iraq. Sometimes he's very close to the Americans. Right now, I think quite recently he's dropped off. He's not quite as favorable, you know, seen as favorably as he was. But he for a while there, he just most recently, he gets these committees. He was in charge of some committee to help reconstruction and services and bring back services, you know, like water and electricity and health, and, I mean, then hospitals and medical care to Baghdad. Didn't work out very well, we've seen, but he was in charge of that, trying to run that committee. And, hey, he's organized, so people think he's a good choice sometimes.
Unbelievable. The book is The Man Who Pushed America to War, The Extraordinary Life, Adventures, and Obsessions of Ahmed Chalabi by Aram Rostin. Aram, thanks very much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, David.